The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Reach.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to Too Jewish with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is the outstanding head basketball coach of the University of Memphis, Josh Pastner. We'll also have a visit from our international Jewish expert, Tom Price, and storyteller Jordan Hill. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reform Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's fastest-growing synagogue, the only full-service Reform congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Sameach. We're just finishing up the fall holiday season for Jews. We began 3 weeks ago with Rosh Hashanah and conclude today, after 3 weeks of festivals, serious, joyous, and finally riotous. Today is the fun holiday of Simchat Torah, which we celebrate completing the annual cycle of reading the Torah. First five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, for those of you scoring at home. Last night and this morning, we sing and dance with the Torah, celebrating our millennia-old love affair with the book that forms the heart of our great tradition. You see, the process of reading Torah works like this. We divide up the Torah into bite-sized pieces, which we chant weekly, and over the course of a year, we wend our way from the creation of the world at the start of Genesis all the way to the death of Moses at the end of Deuteronomy, at which point we do the Jewish thing and start that same reading cycle all over again. Why, you ask, do we just go right back and read the same book all over again? Isn't there, as Ecclesiastes asks, anything new under the sun? Well, yes and no. Of course, the Torah doesn't change. In fact, it hasn't changed in an awfully long time. The Dead Sea Scrolls prove it goes back at least 2,000 years. Most scholars would put the composition of the final text of Torah between 2,500 years ago and 3,200 years ago. That's an old book by human standards, and it is meticulously preserved precisely so that the text does not change. So if the book's the same, why keep reading it again and again? The simple answer is that although the Torah doesn't change, we do. Each year we change a bit, sometimes a lot. And so we need to constantly set our own intellect and experience and emotional knowledge in a sacred context. In this case, against a book filled with wisdom, great writing, theological belief, and fabulous mythical storytelling that reaches the apex of human creativity. It's not a bad habit to get into, reading, chanting, and studying Torah. To celebrate this holiday of Simchat Torah, which means the celebration of Torah, we begin with a Yemenite Jewish song about the greatness of Torah from the CD The Best of Jewish Song, Mipi El. From the mouth of God, there is none like our God, none blessed like our people, nothing great as the Torah.
Bye.
That was Mi Piel from the mouth of God, blessing for all Israel on this festival of Simchas Torah, Simchat Torah. On Simchat Torah, we celebrate completing the reading of Torah, and we begin again from Bereishit, Genesis. Well, the genesis of a particular personal Simchat Torah goes back to when I was living in Israel, Jerusalem, actually. Having grown up knowing Simchat Torah as a wide-open, fun festival, on the night of the festival, we went looking for a good party. Dancing with Torahs, lots of loud singing, and perhaps a schnapps or two or three or four to celebrate. What we discovered is that that just isn't the way Jerusalemites celebrate Simchas Torah. We wandered the Jewish quarter of the old city of Jerusalem in search of revelry, and we found a couple of decent Torah readings and plenty of stately hakafot, the Torah processionals, but no real party. And so we decided to try the ultra-Orthodox area of Mea Shearim in the new city. Again, no great parties, no Jews dancing in the streets, none of the festivities we Americans associated with Simchat Torah. Where was the Simcha in Simchas Torah? Finally, having found a bottle or two of Arak along the way, we decided to create our own Simchas Torah celebration, by golly, and a group of us began singing and dancing in the middle of a quiet intersection at the entrance to Mea Shearim, the ultra-Orthodox area. We worked up enough enthusiasm to attract a group of younger Orthodox Jews who were willing to come and dance with the Meshuggah American revelers, singing Kihem Chayenu and Hoshia et Amecha and Mi Piel and other Torah songs at the top of our now slightly tipsy voices. We were finally having a really good time when we heard a plop on the pavement near us, and then another, and then another. Finally, we realized that the neighbors living nearby were pelting us with fruit. And not just any fruit, but leftover etrogim, esrog, citrons from the holiday of Sukkot that they didn't need anymore. Only in Jerusalem could you be pelted with esrogs. Well, when we come back on Two Jewish in a few moments, we'll greet our guest and good friend, whom nobody should pelt with esrogs, the outstanding young college basketball coach, Josh Pastner, head coach of the University of Memphis, and the most energetic and positive person I have ever met. Find out what motivates Josh when we return on Two Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, I'm Rabbi Sam Kohan of Temple Emmanuel. What does it mean to be Jewish? A lot of us struggle with that. A great writer named Edmund Flagg wrote, "I'm a Jew because Judaism demands no abdication of my mind. I am a Jew because Judaism requires the devotion of my heart. I'm a Jew because every place where people suffer, a Jew weeps. I'm a Jew because Judaism is the oldest and newest religion. I'm a Jew because for us the world is not completed. We are completing it." Come find out what being Jewish can mean for you this coming year. Join us at Temple Emmanuel as we seek meaning and purpose in our Jewish identities. Call 520-327-4501. Temple Emmanuel, a Reform Jewish community for all of Tucson. Early Childhood Education Center, Religious School, Adult Education Academy, and more. Call 327-4501 for Temple Emmanuel. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish Josh Pastner, a good and old friend, although he's not old, the head coach of the University of Memphis basketball team. You know, usually I have to look up someone's bio to introduce them, but I've had the privilege of watching Josh go from, I don't know how to describe it exactly. I won't say you were the last man on the University of Arizona team, but you'd come in late in the game and take three-point shots, moving on to becoming an assistant coach, a very effective one and a great recruiter, and now head coach at University of Memphis. Welcome to Two Jewish, Josh.
Rabbi, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it, and I know the good fans there in Tucson, Arizona, always loved a Pastner game, because when I got in the game, that means we were 25 or 30 up on the opponent, and that means it was going to be a win.
You know, it seems like that's the last time it was like that, but I want to first of all say Mazel Tov. I know you always wanted to be a head coach. University of Memphis is really quite a high starting point for that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a great opportunity, and been very blessed and very fortunate, very humbled for the opportunity. It's a tremendous school, a lot of success, obviously, the past 4 years with Coach John Calipari. You know, the program was the winningest program in the history of college basketball the last 4 years, so the expectations are very high, which deservedly so, but they've also had super success here in the years past and with previous coaches, even before Coach Calipari. But it's a challenging job. It's not going to be easy. There's going to be times where you're going to have to take a step back to go two steps forward, and it's going to be important that we stay really positive, stay really centered, and making sure that don't get too high with the high or too lows with the lows, because there's going to be some ups and downs, some bumps in the road, but it's not about the just the final destination. A lot of it's the journey along the way, but enjoying every day of being the head coach. Have thoroughly enjoyed it, have not taken it for granted, and enjoy coming to the office every day.
Not to say you're one of the most absolutely positive human beings I've ever had the privilege of meeting. You're coming into a situation in which the coach left. A lot of the great players on the teams that won 30 and more games each the last few years are gone. There's some NCAA stuff going on. You know, you're supposed to follow somebody who didn't do very well so you can shine. Did you miss that page in the coach's training playbook?
Well, it would have a couple things. It would have been, obviously, the so-called external pressure would have been much easier following somebody who didn't have the success that Coach Calipari had. But any job you take, anything that you do, you're going to put, if you really want to be great, you're going to put internal pressure on yourself. So the pressure that you put on yourself will be far greater than the external pressure. So, but based on the job that I have gotten here, the opportunity that has been given to me, you're following a guy who's going to be in the Hall of Fame, and in the last 4 years, the greatest in the history of college basketball. I mean, nobody has done better than what Coach John Calipari did in the last 4 years, and that's who I'm replacing and following. Now, I'm not John Calipari, but I tell people that even as the success that Coach Calipari had, he didn't come in here and wave a magic wand and said, let's have success. It took time. It took time to build. It took time to grow, and people are patient, understood, and I hope the same thing for me is they're going to have to give me that same time as well, too, because, again, nothing's going to happen overnight. It's going to take some time. But we're going to roll up our sleeves, put the hard hat on, and pound the pavement and work like crazy, and making sure that we give the city, our players, you know, obviously the fans, the university, the best chance for their program. When I say their program, I look at this program, the University of Memphis. It's the city's program. The best chance to give them the best chance to win.
We will talk much more with Josh Pastner, the coach of the University of Memphis, and also learn what it's like to be a Jewish head coach at the college basketball ranks when we come back on Two Jewish.
If your parents or other loved ones are in need of assisted living, consider making the choice that Dorothy Daniels' family made, Handmaker.
Living at Handmaker does make me feel very independent, like I was still in my house. The best part of it is I don't have to clean it.
Assisted living at Handmaker promotes an active and independent life. All needs are met, including weekly housekeeping and linen service, transportation to doctor's appointments, restaurants, banks, and shopping. And living at Handmaker is fun.
Every 2 weeks, there is a man who comes with a saxophone, and we dance. And I love that because I love to dance.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes 1 and 2 bedroom suites and cozy studios with patios and balconies.
I would recommend Handmaker to anyone because I feel very safe and secure here. The people that work here are very nice, considerate, and that means a lot.
For a tour and consultation, call 322-7035 or visit their website at handmaker.org.
Where does a rabbi go for his mortgage? I called Scott Rich and his great team, who were terrific when we refinanced. Scott got me the best rate anywhere. He was honest, fast, flexible, dependable, and amazingly helpful, and his staff was the best I've seen. What's usually a challenging process at best was simple and easy. In my experience, Scott Rich is your best source for home loans of every kind. In this fast-changing world of real estate and mortgages, Scott Rich is someone you can trust. Right now, mortgage interest rates are extremely low for refinances and purchases. It's a buyer's market. Take advantage of it. And first-time home buyers can get low rates and the $8,500 tax credit that ends December 1st. Call Scott Rich and his team at Nova Home Loans at 591-8969 and let him make your best interest his first priority. I did, and boy, was I glad. The Scott Rich team at Nova Home Loans. Call 591-8969 or email scottrich@novahomeloans.com. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio. Or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can also get CDs of all past and present shows through the website or downloading us there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. It was Simchat Torah last night, and conservative and Orthodox Jews celebrated today, too, which reminds me of another favorite Simchat Torah story. When I started as a student at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, they asked me to lead Simchat Torah services. I went, sat through the first few hakafot, we do 7 of them, those parades with the Torah, listening to dull, plodding songs. Finally, out of some frustration, I turned to the dean of the college, Rabbi Ken Ehrlich, and asked him what was going on. Like me, he is descended from Eastern European Jews who do their Simchas Torah singing and dancing with great enthusiasm and energy. It's almost wanton celebration, to be honest. Ken laughed and said this was much better. He explained that when he first came to the college, the Torah Hakafot on Simchat Torah were done in a slow, stately procession accompanied by plodding organ music. And he himself had turned to a professor and asked, "It's Simchas Torah. How come they're marching, not dancing?" The professor thereupon answered, "They are German Jews. They are dancing. 1, 2, 1, 2. Well, the next piece of music is a little more like the way we ought to celebrate on Simchas Torah, a klezmer celebration from the great Giora Feidman. We had a great klezmer experience at Temple Emmanuel last night, by the way, but Feidman may even be better. He's the best of klezmer. Itamar's Freilach, it's called. A bit of Giora Feidman's clarinet to celebrate Simchas Torah. I'd like to welcome a special visitor, Harold Price, who is involved in creating the new Anne Frank show at the University of Arizona. Harold, tell us a little bit about what's different about this version of Anne Frank. Some people don't know anything about the Anne Frank show, and some, of course, know it as though it were an old chestnut.
Right. This is a new version we're doing, adapted by Wendy Kesselman. The original authors tried to be as faithful as they could in the 1950s, adapting the diary. Of course, the primary source material. But it was Francis Goodrich and Albert Hackett, and they were kind of better known for Father of the Bride, the original movie, kind of a lot of more sentimental work. They did a lovely job, and probably for the times it was the right way to do it. But what Kesselman has done is gone back and included material that Otto Frank did not initially authorize to be published. He thought it was too personal, so there was a new version of the diary. And then she also took out the sentimental elements, made it more grittier, more realistic, and she also includes at the end of the piece, in harrowing detail, exactly what happened to all of the people from the annex, which, of course, I'm sure everyone knows, only Otto Frank survived.
Right, and I mean, the fact is that he eventually went back and found the diary, and then more information was released several different times in subsequent, I guess now it's decades. It's quite a challenging truth. Anne Frank, whom we think of as this sort of beautiful soul, was also an adolescent girl who got in fights with everybody around her and, you know, wasn't quite sure what she wanted to be.
Exactly. She's really a fascinating character, in spite of the fact that this is, you know, an incredible Holocaust document and just a wonderful testament to this horrible history. But there was on NBC Nightly News two nights ago, there was some film footage of her. Evidently, when her next-door neighbor got married, they caught her on the balcony looking at the goings-on, so that there's a little bit of new footage that you can actually see her as a kid. She's just a regular, you know, kid growing up in Germany and wanting to have a normal life. Luckily for us, she was a brilliant writer. I mean, this is not just an historical document, you know, that would have been fabulous no matter who wrote it. It also happens to be written by a gifted writer that didn't even need to mature. Just the way she wrote at that age was just absolutely tremendous. And so you have great insight and a great take on growing up and living in captivity and on the surrounding things that were happening to them, you know, in that history, in that time.
You know, when I was an adolescent, it seemed like everybody knew about the Diary of Anne Frank. They'd read it. They'd seen the play. It was everywhere. My kids don't really know much about it. Was it a challenge in mounting the production? Did you find that some of your actors really didn't know anything about it?
Actually, that probably, I think that's true. They didn't know too much about it, but I think that kind of helps when you do a production, because it's not then, oh, we're doing another production of this play that we all know. They kind of come to it fresher, and so it actually has a new, strong impact all over again, because they don't know it. If I can do a slight sidebar on that, I'm actually in Pittsburgh as we're talking now. I'm not in Tucson. Mm-hmm. I have a co-director who's opening the show because I'm in Ella, a production about Ella Fitzgerald, and we have a similar dynamic. When kids come to see the show about Ella Fitzgerald, they're coming to it for the first time, and they're not hearing the familiar tunes like the old audience is. Kind of a similar dynamic here with Anne Frank. The older audience knows the story. The younger audience is coming to it absolutely fresh.
It's probably a healthy way to approach it. I should note we're talking with Harold Dixon, who is the University Distinguished Professor, won the James Anthony Award for Sustained Excellence in Teaching, Kennedy Center Medallion of Excellence for his work with the ACT Festival, and many other awards, director of Anne Frank. How can people find out about the Anne Frank show, and how do they get tickets?
They can call the box office at 621-1162. There's also information on our website. Go to UA Theater with an R-E at the end, uatheater.org, and there'll be links. You can actually buy tickets online now. We're finally coming into the modern age.
You've entered the 20th century.
Yes, we was kicking and screaming. They pulled us in.
Thanks, Harold, and best of luck with the Anne Frank show.
Thank you so much, and I'm sure your listeners will just love it. It's just a powerful evening of theater. Thanks very much for this opportunity.
You're most welcome.
The wonderful thing about life at the Forum in Tucson is friends. You live in a vibrant community of peers, people who have had the same experiences you've had, who know that life is for living. Remember how much fun it was to enjoy a great meal with good friends? The Forum at Tucson is like that every night. Whether you choose independent living or assisted living, choose the Forum at Tucson because you've got a lot of living to do. Call 325-4800 today for a complimentary lunch and tour. That's 325-4800 for the Forum at Tucson. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi, and Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach, a very happy holiday of Simchat Torah. You know, one of the interesting tractates in the Talmud is called Smachot, which sounds like celebrations and would mean that, but it's a euphemism. It really refers to how Jews deal with death. And so even though it's Simchat Torah, a celebratory day, it's not a bad day to talk about an interesting Jewish custom, which has resonance in a Japanese film.
Right. There was recently in town, it ran for quite a few weeks and was very well received, a Japanese movie called Departures, about a cello player from a provincial town who gets hired to play in an orchestra in Tokyo. This is his life dream. He's a young man, newly married. He and his wife moved to Tokyo. They're all excited. The orchestra goes bust. It's sort of a third string orchestra, bad economic times. The director comes in and announces with a bow in a very dignified Japanese manner, "Sorry, ladies and gentlemen, the orchestra is dissolved." So this young man goes back to his hometown in the provinces. He has recently lost his mother, and his father disappeared a long time ago. So he goes back with his wife, and he applies for jobs. And he takes a job, which he assumes is with a travel agency, but in fact, it's with a funeral home. And the movie is called Departures, and Departures refers to departure from this world. And he learns the trade. And in the process, you see that Japanese customs for treating dead bodies and treating the corpse with respect and dignity and sanctity are very similar to Jewish and Muslim customs. And what I found so fascinating was that the three friends I saw this with were all non-Jewish women who are unaware of the Chevra Kedisha customs and all the stuff that you just referred to very briefly. And they were amazed, almost overwhelmed, by the dignity, respect, and care with which the Japanese treat corpses. And I said, well, have you never seen the Jewish equivalent? And in fact, for Jews, it's not really a profession. It's a voluntary group of people who do this as one of the highest of all the mitzvot, because you can't be rewarded by the dead person. You can't be seeking favor or currying privilege with somebody who's already dead.
Yeah, Levayat HaMeid, accompanying the dead, doing Chevra Kedisha work, the work of washing the body, a very high mitzvah. Fascinating that it's the same, really, in a way, in Jewish custom and in Japanese custom, and to a degree in Muslim, Islamic right. custom as well.
Right.
Very beautiful way of traveling in a different way on the Simchat Torah. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
When we come back, we'll hear from storyteller Jordan Hill and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant, the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
J-Bar is just a fabulous place to go for a casual, delicious meal.
Thank you, Rabbi.
We go there a lot. What's special this fall?
Well, all the fall products, first of all. So wild forage, mushrooms, things from native seed search, like scarlet runner beans, which we're doing with smoked salmon. Mm-hmm. We've got killer margaritas, views out over the valley. It's beautiful, it's fun, and starts at $12.95.
$12.95, that doesn't seem like enough money. I'm sorry.
You can always spend more.
Great place to go, J-Bar, for casual, delicious food. The phone number is
615-6100. Visit us online, janos.com, or Rabbi, you can follow us on Facebook.
Facebook. Find Janos and the J-Bar on Facebook. Don't miss it this fall.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish is a Public Service. An elderly Jewish couple is sitting together on an airplane flying to the Far East. Over the PA, the captain announces, "Ladies and gentlemen, I'm afraid I have some very bad news. Our engines have ceased functioning. The plane will be going down momentarily. Luckily, there is an island below us. We should be able to land on it. We'll be fine. Unfortunately, this island is uncharted. No one will be able to find us. So the odds are we'll never be rescued. We'll have to live the rest of our lives on the island." The husband turns to his wife and asks, "Esther, did we turn off the stove?" Esther says, "Of course." Then he says, "Esther, are our life insurance policies paid up?" "Of course," she replies. "Good." Then he asks, "Esther, did we pay our pledge to the Jewish Federation?" "Oy, I forgot to send the check. But why could that matter? Why in God's name are you smiling?" "Don't worry, Esther. They'll find us." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature to Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. By the way, somebody told that story about a synagogue collecting money. Let me tell you, compared to the people at the Federation, we synagogue people are amateurs. We now welcome our two Jewish storyteller, Jordan Hill. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Rabbi. With Simchas Torah here, and we're finishing the Torah, I wanted to tell a story that kind of refers to Deuteronomy, the last book of the Torah that we're concluding now, and it's a story that I got from Howard Schwartz. Beautiful story. Goes like this. There was once a man who was studying, a Jewish man, and he was studying the Torah, and he was in Deuteronomy, and he came upon this one line that said, "Justice, justice, you shall pursue." And he thought, this is striking. It doesn't just say, look for justice, it says pursue. And so he decided to take this as a personal commandment. He packed up everything and he left on a long journey, looking everywhere for justice, pursuing it. But everywhere he went, people were hypocritical. People contradicted themselves. No one seemed to know what justice truly was. And eventually he had crossed much of the world. And then he came to a deep forest, one of the last corners of the world that he had not explored. And he entered the forest as a storm was brewing. And as he made his way through the trees and it got darker and the clouds gathered overhead and the wind started to blow, he saw a light flickering through the woods. And he made his way towards there and he came to the entrance of a cave. And there was a fire and there were people. And then he realized his error in approaching so quickly, because the people were robbers. And they looked at him and they said, "Yes." And he said, "Do you know justice?" And they laughed and they said, "There is no justice here. Be gone." And so quickly he left. And as the storm got worse and the rain began falling, he came to a small cabin and he knocked on the door and a witch answered and said, "Yes." And he said, "Do you know of justice?" And she said, "There is no such thing as justice." And she slammed the door in his face. And he kept on going. And then he came to a cabin that was very small, but a bright light was shining from the window. And he knocked on the door, and it was answered by an old man with a black robe and a long white beard. And the young man said, "Do you know of justice?" And the old man just stared at him. And as the rain was falling harder and harder, the lightning and the thunder crashing, he looked past the old man and he saw this long hallway with shelves covered in oil lamps. And he asked the old man what this place was. And the old man invited him inside and said, "These oil lamps are the souls of people. And when one of the flame goes out, then someone dies." And the young man asked the old man, "Could I see my own oil lamp?" And the old man led him down the long hallway to a shelf where there were two simple clay lamps, one with a bright flame and one with a flickering flame about to go out. And the old man pointed to the flickering flame and said, "This one is yours," and walked off. And the young man thought, "There must be some problem. This doesn't make any sense. How can I be about to die?" And then he had a terrible idea. He looked up and down the hallway. The old man was nowhere to be seen, and he picked up that full oil lamp, and he was about to pour some of the oil into his own, when the old man grabbed him by the hand and said, "Is this what you mean by justice?" And all of a sudden, there was a flash of light. The cabin, the old man, the lamps, they all disappeared, and the young man was standing there in the forest, the rain, the storm breaking around him, and all he could think was, "Did I just die? Am I still alive? Am I about to die?" And that is the end, as I heard it.
Thanks, Jordan. We'll get another story next week. And now a word of Torah. Having finished reading the Torah last night, this morning, and this coming Shabbat too, we will read the spectacular Torah portion of Bereishit, Genesis, the beginning of all things. It starts with those still amazing words, Bereishit bara Elohim, at the beginning of God's creating. Simple, clean, creation emanating from one point and place, a divine force or intelligence or energy starting the great process of existence and eventually of life. A poem to the holy unity of all. We all come from the same source. And yet, the text of Genesis is deliberately ambiguous. It encourages exploration and debate, the essential tools we human beings have for learning truth and discerning meaning. Questions abound in Bereishit. Why one God at all? As the great Jewish poet Paul Celan argued, no one needs us again out of earth and clay. No one summons our dust. Blessed art thou, no one. As a rabbi, I would argue with Paul Celan, that's the most Jewish of activities, of course, argument, that such a wondrous creation did not come into being purely by accident. For beauty, it seems, rarely happens by chance in the universe that we know. But there is room for argument, which is good, and perhaps God-given. The notion that God created and then saw each thing as good provoked the great British author D.H. Lawrence to speculate poetically that the true mystery of creation is the divine urge of creation. A great strange urge. It is not a mind. Even an artist knows his work was never in his mind. He could never have thought it before it happened. God is a great urge, wonderful, mysterious, magnificent. But he knows nothing beforehand. His urge takes shape in the flesh, and lo, it is creation. God looks on it himself in wonder, as for the first time. Lo, there is a creature formed. How strange. Let me think about it. Let me form an idea. Again, we could argue, discuss, and explore. Such a marvel as the intricate workings of our world, our bodies, even a single cell, could not happen without some coherent plan or design. But what a rich area for discussion, exploration, engagement, creativity. This is where real understanding and learning start. This is where we begin to shape our faith and our belief. This helps mark our character. This is where Torah starts. So it's a great time of year, and it doesn't hurt that the weather outside in the world that God created is perfect. Our Jewish Poetry Slam this morning features the creation of the seventh day in our Torah portion of Bereishit, Genesis, Shabbat, the Sabbath, from James McAuley's poem, The 7 Days of Creation. The seventh day. Stillness is highest act. Therefore, be still and know the pattern in the flow, the reason in the fact. Sabbath of the mind, the beaked, implacable tearing of the will, arrested and defined. Not to need, either to kill or to possess, is a day's clear weather. The grinding stops. We untether the abused beast and confess we've heard of happiness. The seventh day, a poem by poet James McAuley. It's about Shabbat, for the week when we read about its creation. When we come back on Two Jewish in a few moments, we'll get the news of Jews around the world and hear from our guest, Josh Pastner, the fine young head basketball coach of the University of Memphis. We'll find out if there is a great Jewish hope out there in hoops when we come back on Two Jewish.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road office, 615-8400.
Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Tensions between Israelis and Arabs simmered this week as Arab rioters clashed with Israeli police and Palestinian leaders accused Israel of trying to Judaize Jerusalem. Imagine that. The capital of the Jewish state is now too Jewish? It's kind of funny, since Palestinians have been working hard to deny that Jerusalem is, was, will be, or ever was Jewish. Anyway, these clashes began September 27th, Erev Yom Kippur, the night before the Day of Atonement, when some 150 Arabs stoned a dozen or so Jews visiting the Temple Mount. Riots spread to several Arab neighborhoods in the Old City and lasted throughout Yom Kippur. How convenient. The violence resurfaced this week when Israel restricted access to the Temple Mount, while thousands of Jewish pilgrims visited the Western Wall down below to observe the holiday of course, Sukkot. "We will liberate Al-Aqsa with blood and fire," an Islamic leader, if that's the term, Sheikh Ra'ad Salah told his supporters in eastern Jerusalem, referring to the mosque on the Temple Mount, Al-Aqsa, which is controlled by the Muslims. Not sure how they're going to liberate it. Salah was arrested for incitement. "We call on the Palestinian public to confront Israel and its plans," Palestinian Authority Prime Minister Salam Fayyad said in a statement. No word on what those terrible plans are. Nobody seems to know anything about them. With Arab religious figures calling on Palestinians to flock to the Temple Mount to supposedly protect Muslim holy sites, some Israeli commentators say the rhetoric was reminiscent of the fall of 2000, when violent clashes around the High Holy Days erupted into a second intifada. But a deputy Israeli police commissioner, Mickey Levy, said that this kind of violence is common during the Jewish holidays. Mohammed Dalan, a former Palestinian security chief and Fatah party official, I met him once in Gaza City, by the way, traveling there with a group of rabbis during the late lamented Oslo process. Anyway, Mohammed Dalan said that a full-blown uprising would only harm Palestinians, which is surely true. "We may resort to popular action or civil action. We have an open mind on all legitimate methods permitted by international law," Dalan said, "but we won't push the Palestinian people into a disaster." You mean again? One hopes not. Last week, Israeli police announced that they had restricted access to the mosque on the Temple Mount to just men over the age of 50. I couldn't get in, after discovering wheelbarrows full of boulders throughout the compound. For some reason, Israeli police thought that was a sign of a planned riot. Imagine that. We will stay tuned. In other happier news, Jews have won many Nobel Prizes over the century or so that the prizes have been given, especially in the areas of physics, medicine, and chemistry. In fact, between 1901 and 2008, 178 Jews have been awarded Nobel Prizes. That's nearly a quarter, about 23% of all recipients. Not bad for a people that currently makes up about one quarter of 1% of the world's population and only 2% of America's. This week, more Jewish Nobel laureates were named, including the first Israeli woman to win the Nobel for chemistry, Ada Yonat, who won the 2009 prize for mapping ribosomes, the protein-producing factories within cells, at the atomic level. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences said her work has been fundamental to the scientific understanding of life and has helped research develop antibiotic cures for various diseases. Mazel tov. Watch for more Nobels to come for this small group of people in the world called the Jews. And 139 of the Forbes 400 wealthiest individuals are Jewish, not counting those who don't admit the fact that they're Jewish, and even after last year. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our good friend Josh Pastner, the coach, head coach now at the University of Memphis Tigers basketball team, a very successful program. He took over as one of the youngest head coaches in Division I basketball. Josh, I have an important question about Tennessee. You know, the two premier basketball programs, University of Tennessee and University of Memphis, are now both headed by Jewish coaches. Is there something about the state of Tennessee?
Maybe something in the water. I don't know. You know, the funny thing is when I left the University of Arizona to come to the University of Memphis as an assistant coach, a bunch of my friends in Tucson says, how could you be leaving Tucson to go to Memphis? There's zero Jews in the state there. There's no Jews in the city of Memphis. The funny thing is what a great Jewish population there is here in Memphis, a very strong Jewish population, a lot of, you know, really good synagogues and really good rabbis in the city. So it's a very strong Jewish population here, which is really neat. Funny thing, when I got here as an assistant, I must have received 200 to 300 emails from different Jewish people within the city asking me to come to the different high holidays for meals and prayers.
Services,
so,
right?
So it was cool, and I got married here on May 16th by a rabbi, and one of the rabbis, local rabbis here in the city, and I don't know if you even. Micah Greenstein, I don't know if you've heard of him.
I was about to mention, Mike is a good friend of mine.
I was going to say, and Mike is he's like you, Rabbi. He's just what a spiritual and just a really wonderful human being, and just like being, just like you, you know, very understanding of life and this and everything about being a good guy, being a good person, and being principled. And so what a beautiful ceremony, beautiful service. I've heard him, you know, in fact, this Friday I'm going to try to go to the Shabbat service he has because he's speaking at it, and I like being around, just like I would like being around you. Both of you guys are, you know, you bring out really positive vibes when you're around people. So, so it's been great, and Coach Pearl, he was the coach of the Maccabi games. Well, they won the gold medal
at the Maccabi games.
Which is a tremendous honor, and I congratulated him on that. Yes, we're going to be, you know, battling to try to compete for the same thing within the state and on the court and recruits. But I think I have the utmost respect for Coach Pearl, and I know the job he's done has been terrific there in up in Knoxville, and I'm very proud that he did such a wonderful job in Israel with the Maccabi games.
So you're known for years as one of the top recruiters in college basketball. Obviously, as head coach, you don't get to go out and do it quite the same way. What's the difference? How does it feel differently?
Well, I mean, the difference maybe from the assistant to the head coach with recruiting is you just have so many more responsibilities on an everyday basis that you're not able to divulge all your time into recruiting. Where I was an assistant, really your only focus was recruiting, coaching, academics. I mean, there was, the responsibilities didn't fall on your shoulders. I mean, it was on the head coach, and people wanting to meet with you, they don't want to meet with the assistants. They want to meet with the head coach. So for me, I think the big difference of maybe some of the time taken away from the recruiting has been because of the responsibilities, especially as a first-year head coach. You know, everyone wants to meet you. You need to be out in the community meeting them. You need to go be at different functions. As you know, that's really important to do because a program like the University of Memphis in this city, it's so important to the city. So it's so important that you're involved in the community outreach of the entire city and the surrounding areas.
You were, you know, you kind of were groomed under Lute Olson. You were on the 97 national championship team. You worked for Coach Olson for so many years. Then you came over to Memphis. Obviously, in Arizona, there was a coaching change in the interim. Any regrets about moving to Memphis, and what did you learn from, what have you learned in your time under Coach Calipari as opposed to what you learned with Coach Olson?
Well, I have no regrets coming from University of Arizona to University of Memphis, because obviously without the move, I would never, you know, I wouldn't be talking to you here today regarding the head coaching spot here at Memphis. So it's been obviously the good Lord was, you know, I was very blessed. And let me say this, I didn't want to leave Arizona. And Coach Olson didn't want me to leave, neither did the AD, Jim Livengood, but we all felt the timing was right because in order for me to grow, I probably needed to be at another program just to expand my level of my knowledge and just to learn from another view and see some other things, and it was important to me that I did that. Being able to just pack up and move for me, getting out of my comfort zone, because I had a great comfort zone there in Tucson. Just packing up and moving was really beneficial for me as well, too, because you're in that comfort zone, you're in that mode, you don't want to leave, and then when you leave and it helps you, it makes you grow, and it made me grow. It made me mature in a lot of areas.
Now, there's a history of great Jewish basketball coaches, Red Auerbach, Larry Brown, John Woodenberg, you know, but, okay, John Wooden wasn't really Jewish, but we'd like to claim him. Have you ever modeled yourself on any Jewish coaches?
Well, you know, the funny thing is Coach Calipari was his mentor. The guy that he looks up to the most is Larry Brown, and Larry Brown had come to our practices a few times because that's Coach Calipari. He's really close with Coach Brown, Coach Calipari, as he worked for him when he was coaching at Kansas. You know, I've tried to look up at, take stuff from a bunch of these different coaches. I've read a lot of books, obviously, on Red Auerbach, who unbelievable. I've read stuff about Coach Brown, other coaches out there. I mean, I've taken stuff from Coach Pearl. There's other good Jewish coaches out there, but really, in all, I've really tried to take just different coaches in general, steal a lot of information from them. I tell those guys, hey, the best signs of being flattered is imitation. So I'm going to be taking some things from you, but take it as a sign of flatterness, you know, that I'm taking that from you. But
it's okay.
That I want to imitate it. But you know, so what you do is you gather info, but in the end, you got to develop your own philosophy, feel what you feel is most important and best, and then go from there.
So what's your philosophy of basketball?
Good people want to be around good people. Good people find a way to win. Character is important. I want guys that play hard. I want guys that we are going to, as a staff, that we are going to make sure that each player gets better individually, that they maximize their potential on and off the floor, and that we keep it simple. Again, I want to keep things simple. I don't want to overcoach. I want to make sure that we are really, really good at the fundamentals and the basics of the games, and that just takes tons of practice, repetition, keeping it simple, not trying to outsmart ourselves, and go from there.
Josh, you were also a great student when you were at the University of Arizona. Obviously, big-time athletics and academics don't always work together well. What are you trying to do in Memphis to assure that your student-athletes really are student-athletes?
Well, I mean, you said it best, Rabbi. I mean, you're a student-athlete. You're not an athlete-student. When you come to college, you have an opportunity to get a free education, and you need to take full advantage of that. You don't want the game to use you. You need to be able to use the game. And part of using the game is to have yourself prepared that when basketball's finished, you can be extremely productive in society and embark on a career in whatever you want to do, whether that's in athletics or in business or whatever field you would like to study, take full advantage of that.
Well, I'm ready to play for you. I mean, I'm a little short.
If you can shoot as well as I think you can shoot, I'll have a scholarship here for you if you want to come through Memphis, Rabbi. Anything for you. I would love for you to come be part of the team. I don't know if you got the athleticism I'm looking for.
Might be a little shy on that. And the height may be a problem.
You can fill it up with the jump shot.
Josh, thanks a million. Last terrible question. If you were to predict how many wins you're going to have, how many would it be this year?
Well, a couple things. First of all, if I was really smart, this would be a great time to retire because my approval rating is so high. I can't get any higher right now.
You haven't lost a game.
I am undefeated. I'm one of the few. I'm the only coach in America that's undefeated right now. So that's a positive. I mean, that I tell the fans all the time. I'm beating Coach Calipari right now. I haven't lost.
That's right.
He's got some losses on his record. In fact, I'm ahead of Coach Olson right now. You know. So, but you know, the funny thing is people say, I tell everyone, hey, you know, the 30 wins and all this, that's not reality. It's so hard to do. And all the fans have said, we understand, Coach. We understand. We don't expect you to win 30, but we're counting on 27, 28, 29 wins. And I was like, oh, my gosh. And then I said, well, listen, let me just tell you this. I just want to win my exhibition games, and then I'll go from there. So a reasonable thing is I just want to make sure that we play hard, that we're prepared, and we got a shot to win every game that we're in.
Great. Good luck in the coming season. Mazel tov, both on your head coaching position and your marriage. And we'll talk again soon.
Mazel tov, Rabbi. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Josh. When we come back, we'll talk about next week's guest and get a final musical playout on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Come back next week. Our guest will be Lieutenant Colonel Marshall Grant of the Israeli Defense Forces, talking about what it's like for an American immigrant to Israel to serve in the IDF. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from Mark Bloom and his CD, Funky Punky Holidays. It's an Elechamna Libi medley for the festival of Simchat Torah last night and today. My friends, may you have a final Chag Sameach, a delightful and grateful holiday of Simchat Torah, and a wonderful ending to your Jewish festival season, and of course a week, we pray, of peace.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.